So we'll start with the new topic today, which is I/O and file systems. But let me recap what we did last time. So we were talking about page replacement algorithms. So this is basically to deal with the issue of whenever there is a page fault and you are bringing a new page from disk, you have to evict a page. The page replacement algorithm tells you which page to evict. Looked at a number of policies, starting from random, FIFO, min, LRU. Min is the optimal one, but it needs knowledge of the future, which typically you don't have. LRU tries to approximate min by looking at the past and assuming that the recent past is a good predictor of what's going to happen in the future. And random, we didn't really talk about, but random actually works reasonably well. You just pick a page at random and evict it. And we have looked at FIFO. And then we spent some time talking about implementing LRU. The basic point to keep in mind is any page replacement algorithm that has a bookkeeping overhead that incurs additional memory accesses is going to be bad in terms of performance. So essentially the implementation is all about how do you minimize bookkeeping. If the bookkeeping requires extra memory access, then for every memory reference you have all these additional overheads. And that we want to avoid. So we looked at second chance, which is also known as clock, which keeps track of sync bits in the TLB, and it uses these bits to track which pages have been accessed and so on. We looked at enhanced second chance that keeps two bits, one that keeps track of the access bit and one that is keeps track of the modify bit. Okay, and then we looked at how do you do the page replacement across multiple processes. We looked at per process allocation, we looked at global LRU, looked at advantages and disadvantages of these techniques. So you should know all of this in terms of multi-programming considerations. Okay? There's one thing I forgot to do last time, which I'm going to cover today, and then we will switch to file system. And this is basically the issue of how the kernel allocates memory. Okay? We assume basically that the processes are paged in and out. Okay? Typically the OS kernel itself may not be paged in and out. You pin a few pages and then the kernel resides in memory. Okay? And the kernel data structures are also dynamically allocated. As processes come and go, new data structures get allocated. So the kernel has to do its own memory allocation, which is separate from everything we have seen so far for processes. Okay? So the way typically it's done, there are two that are widely used. One is called the buddy allocator. It's called the buddy algorithm. There's another one called the slab allocator. So let me briefly talk about these and then we will sort of end the discussion on memory allocation. So in the buddy allocator, the kernel memory that is available for allocation for data structures is basically maintained in sizes of 2 to the power n bytes. Okay. So essentially, let's say you start with, just to pick a number, 128 byte slab. I mean, usually it will be larger. And as memory allocation request comes, you basically take this and chop it up into smaller parts of the size 2 to the power n, and this is this allocation size. So let's suppose you get a 3 byte request. Okay, what you will do is you will first partition this into 264 byte chunks. And then you will take the 64 byte, one of them, and chop it up into 232 byte chunks. Take the 32 byte chunk, you will chop it up into 216. Let's just make this 7. Just to be. Take the 16, and then you will basically end up with an 8 byte chunk. Okay? This is what you will allocate for this request. Okay? So now you have basically a 64 byte chunk, a 32 byte chunk, a 16, and an 8 byte chunk. So you will keep track of those. And as new requests come, you will basically take one of these. Okay, that you round it up to the next higher power of 2, you take one of those and you allocate those chunks. Okay? In other words, kernel memory is allocated in fixed sizes of 2 to the power n, independent of the size of the request. You just round it up to the next power of 2 and allocate that. Okay, this is for ease of allocation. So you don't have to keep track of arbitrary size chunks. Okay. This is what is done. As you can imagine, there will be a lot of fragmentation, internal fragmentation here. Okay. Not external, but internal fragmentation. Because if you basically ask for let's say 33 bytes, you will essentially get a 64 byte chunk. Okay, that's the next higher power of 2. So you will basically waste some space in that chunk. Okay, this is what happens in the buddy allocator. Okay, this was used by early versions of Linux because there is internal fragmentation. It has been replaced in most kernels with what is called a slab allocator. Okay, is the buddy allocator clear? What it does? Okay, the reason it's called buddies is basically you have all these powers of 2. If you have any 2 power of 2, you can coalesce them and create a larger block again. Okay, so you have these buddies. For every piece of memory basically has 2 parts of equal size of that, you can chop it up into, those are called buddies. Okay, so that's the old style allocation that kernels used to do. The new style is very different. Okay, this tries to get rid of all of this internal fragmentation. What it does is, this is called a slab allocator. Okay. A slab is essentially some contiguous chunk of pages. Okay, so they will define a slab as some contiguous chunk of pages. Okay, so let's take, let's say page 1. These are 3 pages. Okay, this is a slab of 3 pages. So what the kernel now needs to allocate smaller pieces from these 3 pages, and the way this is done is, for every, this is only kernel memory allocation, so you can do, may do some optimizations. For every data structure that the kernel wants to allocate on the fly, on demand, you will have a slab. Okay, so let's say for a PCB you will have a slab. Okay, for a semaphore you may have another slab, and so on and so forth. Okay, so whenever you create a new process, you will allocate a new PCB, okay, process control block, and that data structure, that item will be allocated from the PCB slab. Whenever you allocate a new semaphore, you will allocate it from this slab. Okay. So what you have essentially done is you have chopped this pages into smaller pieces of thick size, each of which can hold a PCB entry. Okay. Some of these entries will be in use and some will be free. That's anything that's shaded is in use. Okay, and there is a object cache which keeps track. It's almost like a page table. It keeps track of which entries are in use and which ones are in free. So if you want to create a new process, you'll basically say allocate a new PCB. You look through the PCB slab, you'll find a slot. Okay, and the slot is exactly the size of a PCB slab. This is known a priori because all kernel data structures, you know what they are. So the kernel designer has actually will basically use that information to construct this slab. So if you want a new PCB, you will scan through this, you will find one slot that is free and say, okay, that's the one I'm allocating. You will add an entry to the object cache, and that's where the new PCB resides. Okay. So this is a very special allocator, where you are allocating memory chunks exactly as requested, but you know ahead of time what are all possible chunks I could request. Right? These are all the data structure that the kernel wants to request. There may be 10 or 20 of those. So you will take those into account and you will construct slabs for each of those separately. So you will never in a slab mix 2 different things. You won't put a PCB and a semaphore in this slab and cause some fragmentation. Okay, so each slab will be partitioned into some number of slots, each of which can hold one entry for that slab, okay, for one data structure entry for that slab. Is this clear what I said? Any questions? This is a very special purpose allocator. Okay, you could do this in your user program. Let's say you basically have only 2 types of objects that you want to allocate on the fly within your program. You could envision a special allocator that you write for your program alone, that takes a large chunk of memory and then doles out memory in units of that object size. Okay, whenever you say new on that object, you will take one slot and say this is where the object is going to reside. Okay. You cannot in this scheme allocate some arbitrary memory chunk. Okay, you have to predetermine what are the different things you can allocate on demand and construct slabs for them. Okay, that's essentially what the kernel does. Okay, separate object cache and separate slabs for each data structure, a process control block, a page table is another important one, a semaphore, and so on and so forth. Okay. This was originally designed by people who wrote the Solaris kernel, and since then it's been adopted in many other operating systems, including Linux. Okay. The buddy allocator in Linux is now replaced with the slab allocator. So that's how the kernels manage their own memory. Okay. So there's no paging. So as kernel is concerned, okay, memory has to be allocated, or pages are pinged, and then memory is allocated dynamically in this fashion using one of these two algorithms. So that's something to keep in mind. So the kernel memory is managed differently from user space, okay, any address space. That's the important bit to keep in mind. Any questions on this? Yes, no? Okay. Okay, so with that we will move on to the next major topic. So now by this time we have actually covered two of the three major, there are actually four components of the course. The last one is distributed systems. Okay, but as far as operating systems go, there are three key components: processes and address space, processes and threads, address spaces and files and IO. Okay, so we've done processes, address spaces, we just finished this topic. Okay, memory management. Now we are going to look at storage and IO management. Okay, that's basically the next several lectures. Okay, so as far as what resources we are talking about, we have done CPU, we have done memory. Now we are going to look at disk, okay, as an example of a storage device. Okay, so there will be various aspects of this, okay, and various layers that we'll look at as far as disk and storage management is concerned. Today we will talk about the file system functionality. Okay, and then we will sort of delve deeper into how do you use the file system, how do you implement a file system rather, and how does the file system manage space on disk and so on. Okay, today we are going to talk about the upper layer of the file system, which is how do users interact with the file system. Okay, starting next class we'll talk about how does the file system interact with the disk. Okay, that's really where the more interesting stuff is happening. This is just the interface that you are presenting to end users. Okay, you are probably familiar with this interface. If you return any program that does IO, you are essentially using that interface to interact with the file system. Okay, so once you understand that interface, then we have to ask the question, how is that file system implementing that interface? Okay, how does it then take any of the calls that the users make and manage the disk space? Yeah, so we'll talk about the interface. So these set of calls are basically system calls, okay, that any Unix-like file system exports to users. Okay, you probably have heard of them at least. You may not have used them directly. So you open, close, read, write, and then there are a whole bunch of directory calls. Those are file system calls. There are calls to manage directories and so on. Okay, typically, as I mentioned very early on, when you write your user programs, you don't interact at the level of system calls. Okay, so if you write a Java program, if you are doing any file IO, okay, you probably use the file package to do the IO. Okay, you do file.read or readline or file.write or something like that. Okay, what is happening internally is the JVM takes your calls and then it invokes the system call interface. Okay, same is true in C or C++. Okay, in C you use the C library. Okay, you may use scanf and printf and whatnot. Okay, fscanf. Okay, those get translated into system calls. Okay, you use system calls, you can certainly write programs that directly use system calls, but then you are programming at a low level interface, using a low level interface, and you do this only if there are good reasons to program at the system call level rather than use libraries to interact with storage. Okay, so although we say this is the interface that's exported to the user, the important thing to keep in mind is when application programmers write programs, they will not program at this level. Okay, there are libraries that sit on top that export a still higher level interface to real users or application designers. Okay, so that's a system call interface. We'll talk more about this. Okay, and then the system call interface below this is basically the device interface. Okay, this is the interface that the operating system uses within device drivers, for instance, to talk to the disk. Okay, this is a very low level interface that's very disk specific. Okay, so for a normal magnetic disk, you may have things like read a block from the disk, seek to a particular block, write a block, and so on. Okay, if you have some other device, let's say you have a USB thumb drive, that interface will be different. Okay, that depends on the device driver and the device itself. What is the right interface? Okay, so this is device dependent. This is all device independent. Regardless of what device it is, once you construct a file system on it, you will use the exact same high level interface to interact with it. It's the job of the file system to translate this to the device specific calls that then go to the actual device. Okay? So in this class, we'll only focus on one device, which is normal magnetic disks. I may say something about solid state disks, which are different from magnetic disks, but that's the only device we will really talk about. But in reality, there will be a whole class of devices, everything from DVD and CD-ROMs, which are write once, read many devices. Only you write to them once, but after that you can only read from them. Okay, two read-write devices ranging from tape drives to hard disks to solid state drives and so on. Okay, so each of them is different and you interact with them in a different way. Okay. So we'll now talk about the programmer interface and some properties that the file system gives you. Okay. So what are the user requirements on the data that you are trying to store on the device? The first and the most important one is persistence. Okay. If you write something to your disk, okay, you assume that the data will be there across reboot cycles. Okay, this is persistent. Data is not going to disappear if you reboot your machine. Okay, memory contents are volatile. Contents on disk should be non-volatile or persistent. Okay, so this you care about. Okay, then other things are just nice things to have. Speed, you want to get to your data as quickly as possible. Size, you don't want to be limited by artificial restrictions. If you have a very large disk, you want to be able to store lots of data. You want to be able to store very large files. Okay, if you get a terabyte disk, which costs barely $100 these days, okay, you want to be able to use that disk to store large files. Okay, you don't want the file system to say, no, you can only create 10 megabyte files. Okay, for instance. Okay. Size and the sharing and protection, you need capabilities to say who can access this data, who do you want to share it with, and ease of use. Okay. Ability to easily find, examine, modify it. This is actually becoming more important these days. Okay. As everybody seems to be getting lots of devices, you typically cannot remember where you stored a file. You may have a desktop at your work, you may have a laptop, that's a different device. Okay, then you probably created a file somewhere, you stored it somewhere, you may have forgotten where is the latest version of the file. Okay. So the ability to do this is actually getting more complicated. As you create more and more content, it's even harder to understand exactly what versions of the contents are stored where. Okay. And this is not just true for users. Organizations have similar problem. Okay. So just to give you an example, 2 weeks back we had a visitor from Hollywood studio. Okay, so now all movie production has gone digital. Earlier you would actually capture this on analog film, but now everything is captured in digital form. Okay, this on the one hand is good, but the bad part of it is now that everything is digital, you can create various versions of a movie, for instance. Okay, so you can, once you have a master, you can create a version for each geography. May have a version for Asia. Okay. Maybe some part of it got censored in a particular country, so that part has to be clipped out. Okay, so, and so on and so forth. Maybe in some cases you have a 3D version of Avatar and 2D version of Avatar. So a whole bunch of them. So their problem seems to be they have so many versions now that everything is digital. You create all these versions willy-nilly and now you have lost track of what exactly is stored in what movie, what version is it, what is there in it, what is not there in it. So going and trying to find anything has become a nightmare. Okay? And for them, each movie is about a terabyte in size. Okay? Your 100 versions are 100 terabytes, that's just one movie. And you may be doing tens of these movies at the same time, you have a library of these, of all these old movies. So quickly you have all this content that you have created. Okay. And same is true of people, right? You basically start taking all these digital photos. I have 10,000 photos on my laptop. I need to find something is very difficult. Okay. And in 10 years, probably I'll have 100,000 pictures. Okay. Each of them is a file, but now how am I going to actually go and look for the one I really want? Okay. So this is not a problem to be ignored. Okay. I mean, it is all fine to say you give it good names and then you can remember everything, but as the content that you create is exploding, okay, that has become a big problem. Okay, so now file systems have to somehow cope. Today's file system clearly cannot really address this issue very well. Okay, but new versions of file systems are being created where some of this problem is being addressed. All these other ones I think file systems seem to have a grip on. Okay, this one is not an easy problem. It's actually gotten worse, not better, with time. Any thoughts or questions on this? Yeah. You could use metadata tags, but it's, so you're right, I will talk about file system indexing and use metadata type. The issue is your depends on who is generating the metadata. There are systems like on Mac OS X that are automatically constructing metadata and indexing it. Okay? But that may not capture user intent. Like, so maybe you have 100 versions of a movie, right? The example I was giving you. You can certainly, it's not a question of I don't know where the files are. It's the problem is I don't know what's in the files. Okay? What was it created for exactly? What has been taken out? And capturing that information automatically is much harder. Then you're relying on users to go tag things and whatnot. And that's really where the problem is. The same thing with, I have 10,000 photos. There's no way I can go and start putting tags saying I took this picture here, right? So it's just I generate more photos. I don't have the time to do it. Right? How can the system help me? So typically systems can only do so much, but they are not that intelligent. So that's where the problem is. What do you rely on the system to do automatically? What do you rely on the user to provide? And the less you demand from the user, the more usable that system is. If you expect everybody to be perfectly organized, this is not a problem. But people are not organized by definition, right? Okay. So what hardware and OS features do we have to deal with this? Okay. So hardware. If you look at magnetic disk, you already get the first three properties. Disks are persistent. If you store something on bits, on the disk, those bytes are recorded. They don't go away. Okay. Speed. Okay, disks have gotten faster over time. If you have solid state disks today, they are of several order of magnitude faster. Okay. So speed, we are getting there. Okay. And size, disks seem to be getting bigger. I think I missed a zero here. That should be 2000 gigabytes. So today you can just get like a 2 terabyte disk. That's the biggest disk you can buy. What you store on it, I don't know. But people seem to fill it up in any case. Okay. So sizes are getting bigger, speeds are improving. And what the OS is giving us is using those hardware features, you have this abstraction of a file, okay, which is basically, when you say file, you basically expect that file stay on your disk. Okay, unless your disk dies or something, but so long as it doesn't fail, okay, you don't have a problem because the systems are persistent. On top of the persistent that the disk gives you, the OS can do additional things. Yeah, I'll briefly mention this later. You can basically replicate data on multiple disks. So if one disk dies, the data resides on another disk. So you can add recovery and redundancy, okay, on top. Using things like multiple disks and RAID arrays and whatnot. That's not really the goal of our discussion, but I'll mention them as we go along. Okay. Sharing and protection, you have all these file system features to provide privileges or access control lists on files, another thing we'll talk about. And ease of accounting. Okay. You can basically give file names, can organize large collections of files into directories, your transparent mapping of files to disk blocks. User doesn't really care about where on disk a file is stored. File system takes care of this. Last thing which I was talking about, ease of use. So modern file systems have search capabilities. Okay, they automatically go index things. You can fire off search queries to go locate your content. Okay. But the file systems can only go so far. Okay, they can only have so much intelligence of what is a file supposed to mean to the user. Okay, so you can do only so much with it, but still they have come along. Okay, they are sort of getting better. There's Spotlight in OS X, Windows. There has been a project that seems to be going on forever. They wanted to completely change the architecture of a file system, okay, to make it look more like a database where anything and everything becomes queryable and searchable. Okay, so rather than storing files and then trying to search, basically add structure to the files you query and so on. So NTFS was going to get all of these capabilities. They have been promised for a long time, hasn't materialized. It's still an internal project, but things are getting rolled out. Like things like this are actually coming out in more modern versions of operating systems. Okay, so let's talk about files. Okay, so this should be all. I'm going to go through this quickly because it's all intuitive. Okay, by file we basically mean a logical unit of storage on a storage device. This is the granularity of storage on your disk as far as the operating system is concerned, is a file. Okay, so essentially a formal definition is a named collection of related information stored on secondary storage. Okay, all files have a name, so it's a named collection of bytes. Okay, so you have a group of bits that you're storing, you give it a name. Okay, that's essentially a file, and these bits are stored on a non-volatile medium. Okay, that's also important. these are some typical file names. Files can contain user, program, whatever you want. Okay. The more important thing is what does the file system assume a file contain. Okay. There are two camps here. Okay. One camp basically says that the file system shouldn't really worry about what's in a file. File is an opaque collection of bits. We don't really care what the bits mean. Okay. This is a Unix philosophy. Okay. File basically is just a collection of bits. File system doesn't interpret. Okay. On the other hand, you basically have this other camp which says files can be structured. The file system actually knows about what's in a file. It knows about file types in particular. Okay. If you have files with certain names or extensions, those are interpreted accordingly by the file system. Okay. If you have something called PDF, .pdf or .doc or .powerpoint, this means something to the file system in this other camp. In the Unix world, names are just strings. Okay. You could have a .pdf, but you could store an image. As far as Unix file system is concerned, it doesn't care. Okay. In the structured camp, it matters. Okay, what's in the file. Okay. So these two camps, depending on the platform you are on, you get one or the other. Okay. So that's the Unix way, and Windows is and OS X are somewhat different. So what? There are these other types of file systems which we will probably not study in detail, but they exist. So these are stored on mainframe. Okay. So here the file is basically a series of records or objects. Okay. File has a structure. Not only does the name and the extension mean something, the contents of the file also have a structure. So you will say a file is a collection of records. Each record has this structure. So you can only store data in that structure in that file. You cannot deviate from this. Okay. So these type of file systems were designed as early versions of databases. Okay. So essentially these kinds of things now exist, live inside databases rather than as general purpose file systems. But early file systems actually had this kind of structure that they imposed. And you could, once you say I want to create a file, you have to specify what the structure of the data that you are going to store in the file is. Without that, you can't create a file. You say, okay, my file is going to contain 16 byte records. Each record has two fields, they are two integers. You have to specify this. And you can only store that type of data in that file from that point on. You can't just store some other type. Okay? So there are these other file systems. Keep that in mind. We'll not talk about them anymore. Okay, and then the last thing is the name that you have associated with the file, and there are multiple attributes. Okay, type, location, protection, creation time, and whatnot. Okay, just to give you an example, you probably all know this. Okay, so let's look at on OS X. If you actually do this, you should see some interesting stuff. Right, so this is all the standards of the type of the file. So if you'll see that here the file system keeps track of what type of file it is. It says it's a PowerPoint presentation. Okay, it's figured that from the name of the file. More importantly, it says if I try to open this file, this is the program you associate with it. This can be changed. Okay, so you can actually go change it on a per file basis or across the system. You can pick something else, for instance. Okay, and this is all metadata that is stored with the file. This is stored internally in the file system. It says this is what needs to happen if somebody tries to open this file. Okay, and then there's a type of the file, that's the usual stuff, the size and who created it and whatnot. Okay. And then there are additional things which I guess are not shown here. There's additional metadata, okay, that is generated. So for instance, you can actually fire off a search here. But let me show you something. So there is, all those files are cataloged. So if you use this thing called MDFind and you say lecture 18, so it is going to look, so it found all files that have that string in their name. Okay. If you can also search inside files, and then it will find all files that actually have the string lecture 18 appearing. So all of those files also have that at least that string. There may be several others. Okay. So this is basically created by indexing files. Okay. It's almost like a search engine for your file system that is layered on top. Okay. It has gone and indexed everything. It's figured. So if you fire off queries, it looks up the index exactly the way Google works. Okay. Google also goes cross documents, indexes them. Okay. So you have all of this stuff that the file system keeps track. These are now all attributes. as far as the file system is concerned, also called metadata. Okay, data is where the actual content resides. Metadata is information about the data, okay, which is the name, type, location, contents, indexing information, and so on. Okay, any questions on this? Okay. So this is the user interface. The file system, they are specified as system calls typically. Okay, both on Unix like file system and on Windows. These are all Unix versions of the calls. So you have create to create a file, okay, open to open a file, read and write to read and write to it, you can delete files, close, you can seek within a file and whatnot. Okay. And then there are all these other things you can do on the file. You can change the attributes on the file. Okay. You can basically set an attribute, you can create links to the file, create soft links, create hard links, get an attribute, rename files. And there are a whole bunch of other calls on directories, okay, folders that you can create. They are not listed here. Right? Typically, okay, let me just show you another example. Okay, so this is create, I left out the E. Okay, so this is basically a call that you make to create a new file. So this is the system call. Right? So you specify the path name, specify a mode. Mode is basically a set of bits that says is it read only, write only, which sets the execution bits, and it basically tells the system what to do. Okay, so it's been replaced by open, which can also create files for you. That's the open system call. Okay, so similar call. So you have all these calls. These are some things you best usually don't use because when you program at a higher level, but then your runtime actually uses these calls. You can see that you can open a file in different modes. Okay, read only mode, read write mode, append only mode. OCreate says create this file if it doesn't exist. It says get a shared lock on the file, open the file in locked mode so nobody else can access it. The whole thing, set of things you can do. Okay, this is the interface that the operating system, or in this case the file system, has exported to you. Okay, this is how user programs will actually interact with the file system. Okay, that's basically this interface. Okay. So how do these interfaces get implemented? This is really a file system specific question, but all file systems have to do certain things. Okay? When you open a file, okay, there is some state that the kernel is going to maintain for that process. Okay? Each process, okay, the process control block, so we looked at the process control block has process and scheduling specific information, it has memory management information. Okay, all the page tables and so on. The third kind of category of information that's in the PCB is all the I/O that the process is doing. Okay? For every process, the operating system keeps track of all the files that are opened by the process at this point in time. What are the files? Where in the file is this process actually doing either reading or writing? And a whole bunch of other statistics. Okay? So this is basically kept track by the file system. There's also a global table which keeps track of all the files that are open. Okay? So there's this open file table. Okay, this is kernel data structure. Okay? That says for each file, how many processes are opened at file, what are the file attributes, the location on disk and so on. This is one data structure. Okay? And this per process file table is actually kept in the process control block. This is what I just mentioned. For each file that the process is opened, okay, there's some information that is in the OS. The OS has to keep track of this, all of this. So when the user basically sends off a command, you need to look up all of this information to figure out what is the right thing to do. Okay. So these are the kernel level data structures. Any questions on this? Okay, so let's quickly talk about a few key system calls and see what needs to be done internally to implement. The simplest one is create. Okay. Create essentially says create a new file. Okay, with the particular name that is specified. So the arguments are the file name, okay, and then this basically says create a new file. So what does the kernel do? Okay. First thing it has to do is check whether there is disk space. Okay, if your disk space is full, you'll get an error. Okay. Second thing it has to do is do additional checks, which says, do I have permission to create this file? Okay, because all files will be created in a directory. If you do not have write access to that directory, you cannot create files in that directory. So you need to check the permission bits. All of this the OS has to do before you can even create the file. Once you have checked and made sure you can create the file, then you create a file descriptor saying, now let me create a new file. To do this, I basically have to create a new file descriptor on the for the file with the name of the file that's been specified, the location of that file and other attributes, okay, which is the user that created this file or sent off that command and whatnot. Okay. And then you attach that file descriptor to the directory that contains the file. Okay. This is data structure that the file system keeps. Okay. So keep in mind there are two types of data structure. This is the data structure, okay, that's kept in memory by the kernel. Okay. In addition to this data structure, there are on disk structures. It says what are all the files on this disk. Okay. Where are the files located? Who created this file? So when you do ls, this is what the ls command actually reads from disk and shows you. Okay, so this is this other set of data structures that are on disk. So when you create a file, you allow to add an entry saying I just created this new file in the appropriate directory with all of the right things. Okay, and then optionally there will be a file attribute associated with it. Okay, so if your file system actually keeps track of file types, and it has to create all this metadata. So if it's .doc or .pdf, you do something specific, saying this is a PDF file, this is the program that you need to use to open it, and so on. Okay. So there are, as I said, there are these two camps, and there are advantages and disadvantages to using file types versus not associating types to files. Okay. The advantages are it's basically better error detection. Okay, if the file is of a certain type and you have some other type of data, you can say it's corrupt because you know what the structure of that file is. Okay. You can do default operation. If you do double click, okay, the file system doesn't know what type of file it is, it's not going to be able to do anything. If double click essentially tells the OS, open this file for the user. Okay, it has to fire up a program that's associated with that file type and open that file. Okay. If you don't have a file type, there is nothing the OS can do. Okay. So in Linux, there are no file types by default in the file system. So the OS cannot do anything when you say open that file. It doesn't know what to do with this. Okay. Now there are other things that are layered on top of the file system that might keep this metadata separately. Okay. So if you have X Windows, for instance, your KDE or GNOME or things like this, they go and associate file types. Okay. But that's not in the operating system or the file system. This is done at the user interface level or in user space. In many cases, this is in the file system that makes it better. Okay. The disadvantage is it makes the file system more complex, because for every type of file that you could possibly store on disk, it has to keep some metadata saying what's the program to use to open it, what does this file type mean. Okay. And there could be hundreds or thousands of different file types. Okay. So that's an additional complication. So it's a Unix opts for simplicity, no file types. Windows and Mac opt for user friendliness. They actually associate types with files. Any questions on this? Okay. So delete is the other call. Delete is fairly simple. All you have to do are three things. Okay. One is first find the file and make sure that you have permissions to delete it. Okay. Once you have done this, then you do two things. One is you go and actually free up the disk blocks that the file occupies. Mark them as free. Okay. And then remove the file descriptor from the directory. Okay. Remove the entry in the directory saying this file is now gone. Okay. These are two things that are essentially done. Okay. This does not mean that the data no longer resides on disk. Okay. All you have done is you have marked the blocks that were associated with the file as free. The data that was contained in those blocks is still on your disk. Okay. So when you delete a file, don't assume that the data is gone. Okay, data is still going to reside on disk. Eventually, when you create new files, new data, that data will override the data that's on disk. Okay? This is typically why you can do undelete of files. Now, all of the structures are still there. You can actually go and look for all of those blocks and recover. This is how really companies that do law enforcement can actually go and look at a disk and recover data that was actually deleted. Okay. The only way to really delete a file is to actually use a program that not only does these two things, but then it actually goes to each data block that was contained in that file and overrides it with garbage multiple times. There is only way to actually make sure the data has gone away. Okay? But most people don't realize this. So if you think you may deleted a mail, you really didn't delete it. It just went away from your inbox. It may still reside on disk somewhere. Okay, same is true of Google Mail, for instance. It may be residing somewhere you don't know. Okay? So delete means different things. Okay? Delete just means no longer visible to the user, the file system, but the bits might still reside on disk. Okay? A couple of other things to keep in mind. We will talk about file system aliasing soon. Okay, file system aliasing essentially says there are two names for the same file. Okay, this is what typically soft links or hard links mean. Okay? And whenever you delete a file which has multiple links, if there is some other link that's still active, the file may not even go away. Okay, it may be accessible using its other name. It just becomes inaccessible using this name. So here is an example. Okay, so let's say this is a file. You have Firefox. So you have these two names that point to the same file. Okay, this is referred to as a hard link, or sometimes if you do it differently, it could be a soft link. Okay. So two names, you can open the file using either of these two names, you get to the same file. Okay, it just says that the file has two names, not one. Okay. If you delete, if you do RM of this, the only thing that happens is you basically just take that out of that directory, this one still remains active. So the file has actually not even gone away from this. Just removed from the directory of the first name. Okay, but the second one remains active. If you then go and delete, do this. Okay, at this point, basically these blocks are marked as free. Not removed, just marked as free. Okay, somewhere, and then this entry is removed from that directory. Okay. So there is something called a ref count for the file, which says how many different names refer to this same file. Okay? Only when the ref count goes to zero does the file system actually go and mark the blocks of the file as free. So long as the ref count is non-zero, it says that this file has some other names and those names haven't been deleted from the file system. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so then there's some quick stuff on open and close. Here this should be clear. So when you open a file, you basically again check, first find the file. Okay, this is non-trivial. I will talk about this in just a moment. Okay, and then you create an entry in the kernel data structure. You open that file, you create this file per process file table. Okay, and you initialize the file pointer to the beginning of the file. Okay, at this point, you can start doing I/O on the file. Then you can issue read and write commands. Okay. So the first step, which seems trivial, is actually not that trivial. Okay, when you say find the file, it's basically several things have to happen. Okay, so here is an example. So let's go back to this. Okay, so suppose that's a file. You want to open this file. Okay, what does the OS need to do? How does it know where Firefox or this file is located on disk? Any thoughts on what happens or insights?
Well, first we have to break down that name into parts.
Yes.
It would know like the top level directory that path is this.
Right.
And then it would have to find the set within each one.
Right, recursively. Right. So that's exactly right. So it might look like just opening this file is a simple task, but several steps have to happen before you actually get here. Okay. So you have a name. Okay, this is a fully qualified name. It starts with sort of, this is the full name for the file. So your file system has a structure. Okay, you have a root directory, which is slash, within the root directory in this case there's user, there's another directory called bin, and this file Firefox is a leaf node in this structure. Okay, there may be other things here. Okay, so user and then there may be bin. Okay. So to open this file, you basically, the file system or the operating system in this case has to always start at the top. Okay, first you'll pass this and say, as was pointed out, you'll partition it into piece of saying this file actually has these file name has these three parts. Okay, so user string, there's a bin string and a Firefox string. So you start at the root directory and ask, is there a directory with the string name user in that root directory? Okay, and then you do a you look up that directory, is essentially a table. Okay, you look for a string called user. Say okay, there is a directory. So this is the one. Okay, so then you basically in that table it will give you where the contents of the user are stored. Okay, then you go to that user directory. You are just doing recursive lookups. You look at the user directory and say, is there a subdirectory called bin in that directory? So that's again a table of everything that's in that directory. So you search for something called bin. Say okay, I found it. Okay, so you basically descend down into down the tree. And then you say okay, in this directory called bin, is there a file with name Firefox in there? Okay, so this will again be a table of all the files that are stored. So you search for this file linearly, you look up all the entries, and then you find this file. Okay, and then the entry for this file actually has information for where blocks are on disk. Okay, so then once you actually reach this point, then you look up, do I have access to this file? Do I have sufficient permissions to access this file? If so, then you create a data structure in your kernel saying, I have permissions, I can open this file. Okay, so all of this has to happen. Okay, this is basically name lookups through the file system. Okay, and if the file is actually stored on a remote server, then additional steps have to happen. These are all local files. Okay, but you may be accessing a file stored on a remote server somewhere. So this will allow, this lookup will actually cross multiple machines. Okay, you do some part of the lookup on one machine, the rest happens on the server. So just to point out that this thing which says find the file is actually more complicated process than it sounds. Okay, you have to do all of these additional things. Closing the file is simple. Again, you just remove the entry in the process file table. You decrement the ref count because multiple files, rather multiple processes could have opened the same file. So in this global file table, you keep a ref count, like how many processes are currently have this file open. Okay, so if the ref count goes to zero, that says there are no more processes. Okay, then you can actually delete the entry from the global table. You always delete it from the per process file table, and when the ref count goes to zero, you remove it from the system wide or the global file table. Okay, and then you basically have to open the file again to recreate that entry. Okay, read and write are reasonably simple. Okay, so the read system call gives the file ID or the file descriptor. Okay, your question, yes.
So if more than one file is process opens the file,
okay, so question is, if more than one process opens the file, is there any restriction on who can write? Is that what you're asking? There are no restrictions. Any number of processes can open any number of files. Okay, let's say there's only one file, Firefox. Any number of processes can open this file. Okay, and each process can open the file in whatever mode it wants. Okay, read mode, write mode, read write mode. So long as you have sufficient permissions to do these things, you can open the file in that mode. Okay, so in particular, okay, so let's say this is foo. Two processes can both open the file in write mode. Okay, and they can write and trample on each other's data. So the file system is not going to care. Okay, in reality, these two processes should, if they are actually accessing the same file, they should have coordinated access to the file through locks and whatnot. Okay, simple example where this actually happens all the time is your inbox. Okay, so you have where mail, let's say foo is the username. That's the inbox for this file. Okay, this file is typically accessed by multiple processes. Okay, there is the server process that is delivering mail into this inbox. Whenever new mail arrives, it opens this file and it appends the new mail to this file. Okay, there is also your client process, so you may be accessing it using either the IMAP or the POP protocol. There's a process here that is reading the content. So this is actually writing. This one is typically reading, and it could be modifying as well as you delete mail and so on. Okay. So this is an example of where one file is actually accessed all the time by multiple processes. And the way they coordinate is they actually have to use file level locking to do this. Otherwise, this will not work. Your mailbox will immediately become corrupt. Okay? So the point is, multiple processes can open the same file, and it's perfectly legitimate from a file system's perspective for all of these to read, write all at the same time. The file system will not do any coordination. Okay, it will just accept whatever command you send to read and write, and it will do it. Okay, if that means that the data gets corrupt or overwritten, that's the problem of at the application level that you need to deal with. Yes, question.
But some file systems let you open like exclusive requests, right?
Yes. Yes. So some files, you are right, some file system allow file level locking. In this case, you can open a file with lock mode. So then nobody else can open that file. Not all file systems do this. Okay. So it's not a universal feature. Some file system realize that you actually have scenarios like this where you have to open the file exclusively so that you have a write lock on this file, so others cannot do anything. So they have actually provided locking at the file system level. But this is not necessary for all file systems. Okay, if you don't have locking there, then you have to implement lock functionality at the process level and achieve the same result. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So read and write calls are simple. Okay, so all you do is you basically say, I need to read from this location this much bytes. Okay, that's specified by the size, and you specify a buffer. Okay, then what the operating system does. Yeah, there are lots of things that are not mentioned here. Operating system takes this command and it sends it off to the device driver. Okay? Device driver actually sends the command off to the actual device. This is IO operation. So process is going to block. Any process that issued that call is going to get blocked. The device driver will eventually service the request. Okay? The data will come back from the device, and then the OS will actually copy that data. Yeah, that's what is actually shown here. The OS will copy that data into that buffer, and then the process can go back from the wait state back to the ready state. Okay? So any of these IO commands, okay, actually requires interaction with the device driver within the kernel, interaction with the device driver, and actual interaction with the device. Okay, operating systems also have caches. Okay, that cache recently accessed IO content. Okay, so if you are reading something, you first look in the cache and is this block or the chunk of data that's requested already there. If so, you don't even have to go to the device. Just return it from the buffer cache. If not, you actually have to send a command to the device to do all of this. Okay. As we look at lower level functionality, we will see how these higher level calls translate to lower level calls to the device. Okay. But what is shown here is actually a very naive thing. It's just saying take the file and just copy it, but there's a lot of stuff. This is actually a set of calls that have to happen to the device driver and so on. Okay? So there are two types of calls, random access, sequential access. Random access allows you to specify where in the file do you want to read from. Okay? Sequential access keeps a pointer to the current location in the file, and the next read command essentially reads from that location on. So you are reading sequentially, so you have read until byte I. If you ask for 10 more bytes, you read those 10 bytes and then you advance the pointers. Okay, so basically it keeps track of the current location for this process in that file. Each file has, or rather each process has its own current location in the file. Okay, so you can do either random access or sequential access. Okay, so that's why you have this thing, it says advance the file pointer to the next location. The same is true of write, except that everything is happening in the opposite direction. Data is flowing from the application to the disk rather than the other way around. Okay. So there is one more thing which I hadn't actually mentioned in memory management, which is memory mapping of the file. Okay, this probably some of you may know, but may not be obvious what this is. Okay, memory mapping is essentially a way to interact with files on disk as if this data was actually in memory rather than explicit read or write calls. Okay, so what happens is you have this disk, you have a file here, and then you have RAM. Let's say this is process I. Okay, some process that's currently executing in memory, So one way for this process to access this file is to actually read and write, open read write calls, okay, what we just talked about. Okay. Another way for it to interact with this file is to do what's called memory mapping, which is basically a call called mmap. So what mmap does is it takes a file and it pretends to map it into the process address space. Okay. So there is a mapping that's established that say this is the address space, so byte I to let's say I plus 100, so this is a 100 byte file, okay, are mapped to this file context. Okay. At this point, all that this process has to do is to actually read and write from memory location I to I plus 10, and the operating system automatically translates that to actual IO to the file. So from a processor's point, you are just reading and writing memory location, but this is not real memory, this is just virtual memory. Okay? So these calls are intercepted, saying this is any call, any request to read or write, let's say byte I plus 2, is actually a request to read the second byte from the file. This is automatically done inside, because you just get the abstraction of reading and writing memory chunks, but this gets translated into file level IO internally. Okay? So this is referred to as memory mapping of file. You take a file and you map it into the memory address space of the process, and then all IO operations are from this point on to that file actually happening as accesses to memory location. Just as if you access have an array of bytes and you just read and write those bytes, you can just do that and the actual IO will change the file or read from that file. Okay. So you can access this file as if it was stored in memory completely, although it's not really stored in memory, but it will pretend as if it's stored in memory and you're reading and writing to it. Okay, the question is, does it not create an extra call? So you don't call memory directly. So let's say you mmapped a file into this memory location. Okay, so let's say this is a, think of it as an array of bytes, which is what that is. So at this point, all you have to do is if you say A of 2 equal to some character, let's say C, this is what you do. Right? So what this is doing is actually writing the character C to this location in the file. This just looks like you're doing memory operations. You're accessing an array. Okay, it's an array of bytes, which is essentially that file. Okay, that's all you do. So this is not an extra call. It's just a memory reference. Okay, just as you reference an array, and that gets translated. Okay, you do this only once. The mmap call happens once, which then maps this file into memory, and from this point on, you just access it as if it was stored in memory. Okay? So another system call. Okay, so this basically simplifies IO to the coil. There are no read-write calls, explicit calls necessary. We are pretending to access memory regions and read from memory regions or write to it, okay, just by accessing, doing things like this. Okay, so a few more things before we end for the day. One is the file access method. Okay, typically when you open a file, you can access it from a programmer's perspective either in a sequential manner or what's called a keyed manner. Okay. Sequential, we know. Sequential just says you open the file at the beginning and you read through it sequentially. Okay. Many accesses are just sequential. When you, let's say, open a file in your editor, okay, what's happening is the editor goes and just reads the whole file, okay, and then basically it shows it to you in the editor. Okay. So most programs use this method, compiler reading a source file, editor reading a source file, you write the file, you write it out sequentially. So that's sequential access. Okay. Another way to access a file is keyed access, which says I basically use a key value lookup. Okay? This is how dictionaries, hash tables and databases actually access data that they stored on disk. Okay? So in this case, you basically, so that's your file, you can access any part of the file at any time. Okay? Essentially, this translates to a random access pattern. Okay? So you have key value lookups. So specify the key, you go to that location in the file, you get the value back. Okay? You specify another key, K prime, go to some other location in the file, you get another value back. Okay? This is another way to access the file from the programmer's perspective. Okay? Applications that use this method, as I said, database, search, hash tables, dictionary, and so on. There's not sequential access. K these two translate from OS perspective to these two types of access patterns, sequential and random. Sequential access at the programmer level is still sequential access at the file level. Keyed access at the programmer level is essentially random access at the file level. Okay, you can jump to any random access, and you can jump to any part of the file and read data from that location. Okay, so address any block, given an offset, and then read or write to that location. That's random access. Okay. Now, why is this important? The reason we are mentioning this is when we talk about the file system internals, the file system has to be optimized for both of these access patterns. Okay, so, because the file system does not know a priori when you create a file, how you are going to access it. Is it going to be random access or sequential access, or sometimes random, sometimes sequential? So how it actually keeps track of the data blocks on file, how it gets to those data blocks, has to be optimized or has to work well, not optimized, but has to work well regardless of which of these two you use. It shouldn't be the case that you basically optimize it for sequential. If you're doing random access, performance is terrible. Okay, then some applications will see very bad performance, and applications that do sequential access will see good performance. Or put another way, if you then optimize it for this and you try to do this, you will again have a penalty. So you want to design your file system, okay, so that regardless of the access pattern, you can get to the data in the file efficiently. Okay, next time you will actually see how you can do that. Okay, so this is why it's important to know how applications access the file. So then you can take that into account when you design your file system. Okay, so the last thing here is directories. So you know what a directory is essentially a collection of files or other directories. Okay, so one thing I forgot to mention is so as far as users are concerned, you have a name associated with the file. That's the string you are given to access the file. It's a human readable. So a string that humans can remember and access again. Okay. As far as the operating system is concerned, all files are just numbered. Okay. Each file has a number, unique number associated with it. Firefox could be just some random, pick a number. Okay. So the OS tracks files by giving them numbers. People track files by giving them names. Okay. So internally there is a mapping from names to these numbers associated with the file. Okay. So there has to be a way to actually do this mapping. And the directory is essentially what is that mapping. Okay, a directory is essentially a table. Okay, just think of it as table. It basically gives it some number. Okay, so give it, picks whatever you want. Some number and word. So a directory is the table. Is that these are all the files contained in it, and these are the corresponding numbers for the file. So when you do a table or directory lookup, all you are doing is you are actually getting, translating from the name to the number, and then the file system has to figure out what this number means. How do you actually get to that file? Okay. The other directories are also have numbers, because as far as the file system is concerned, directory is also a special file, just a table. So let's say your subdirectory foo. That will also have a number associated with it. Okay, so you could have arbitrary levels directory. The simplest one, early file system actually were single level, meaning that you couldn't create any subdirectories in there. All the files actually had to be stored at the single level, which meant file names had to be unique. If somebody created a file foo, some other user can't use that name for some other file. Okay, that clearly doesn't work. So well, then you said let's do multi-level, one directory for each user, and now all file system generalize this kind of arbitrary nesting. Okay, so kind of directories that can be arbitrarily nested deep, and then you can have names that are same across directories. Within a directory, file name has to be unique. Across directories, you can use the same file name. Okay, so you can have project1.java in different directories, and that's fine. Each of them has a unique number. Okay, the names are the same, but the numbers that are associated with them are different. Okay. So if you actually go and if you want to look at all this, right? So if you do ls minus I, you actually see, so that's the number associated with that. Okay, so that's basically telling you what is the number that the internally the OS is using to look at each file. Okay, if you just do ls, you will only see this part of the directory listing, but if you do that, you will actually see those numbers. Okay, so multi-level directories I already talked about. Okay, so the last point here before we stop is this aliasing thing I was talking about, also referred to as referential naming. This is just basically, it's called hard links in Unix. This is essentially a way to give a file two different names. Okay, file can have arbitrary number of names. Okay, they all map to the same file, and the way this is done is to basically create what's called a link. Okay, it's a second connection to the file. So if you basically have a file called A, which is file number 100, you use this command in Unix, ln AB, then you basically get another file B. Okay, that has the same name, rather that maps to the same file. Okay, there are two types of aliases you could create: hard aliases and soft aliases or soft links. Okay, soft links are somewhat different. They actually try to do something similar, but they are different. We'll talk about this in just a moment. Okay, so as I was mentioning, when you delete, you basically, if you delete A, all that has happened is the ref count for file 100 has decremented by 1. The file is not deleted because there's another name for the file that's still active. You delete both A and B, then that file is actually deleted from your disk. Okay. Now the important thing to keep in mind is you can create hard links for files, but most file systems will not allow you to create hard links for directories. Okay. So question is why? Why should we restrict that only files can have multiple names, but directories cannot have multiple names? Why should it matter? Any thoughts? There's a picture there. It shows you what can happen if you have file directories that have the same names. Hey, typically, yes, your question.
Maybe when you're making a new link, you look at all of the parent names first,
when you add it, make sure that goes back. Right. So you are providing a solution, but that's I'll come back to that. Typically, the reason you don't want hard links going to directories is that you may get loops. Okay, so here you have directory F that points to a parent. Okay, now that basically has created a cycle in your file system structure. This is problematic for many applications. Think of a backup application. What does it do? You start from the top and you want to back up all the files. So you'll back up B, you'll back up C, you'll want to back up D, so you'll go here. You'll go back up this file E, and you'll say, okay, now I want to back up F, and you'll come back here, and then you'll keep looping. Okay? Similarly, anything that does recursive descent through your file system namespace will have this problem. Okay? The way to get around this is not, well, one solution was you basically look at the parent and say you cannot create a link to a parent. Okay? So you explicitly avoid cycles. Rather than do that, what many file systems do is they allow you to create soft links, okay? Not hard links. Soft links are different kind of aliases. They are basically, I'll talk about them in just a moment. So in that case, you can do links, but that's dealt with then. That can be dealt with differently. Okay? Hard links are indistinguishable. In this case, there is no real way for you to know that A and B are actually the two names for the same file. Okay? Because they look as if they are two different files, it's just that they internally map onto the same file. Soft links are aliases where the file actually constructs. So basically, if you have a soft link to file foo, and you have a bar that also maps to do, what you basically say is in this file, you basically say that I am referring to file foo. Rather than directly adding this pointer, to basically say if I open bar go look at foo instead. Okay? So rather than two things pointing at the same thing, you just store the file name that you want to refer to in the file itself. Okay? So this you can do using ls-s, or they are also called soft. Yes.
Can you do that in Windows?
You can do that in Windows. Yeah. So aliasing you can do in any operating system really. Okay, so if you do ln-s, which is a soft link, basically it doesn't create something called bar, which points here. Rather, it creates a file, okay, which basically says that when you open that file, you basically get an indication saying go and open that file instead. Then you have to go and look up that file and open it separately. Okay, this is referred to as a soft link. It's a shortcut, exactly. In Windows, it's called a shortcut. Okay, so Windows shortcuts are essentially soft link. So what can happen in a soft link is you can get dangling pointers. But you can go and delete this file. This file will actually be removed from disk. But this shortcut may still be will still exist. Okay, so if you now try to open this file, you will get an error because food no longer exists. You will never have this problem in hard links, okay, because the hard links both are actually pointing to the same file. So if you delete one, the other one is still pointing. And the file gets deleted only when the ref count goes to zero. Here there is no notion of a ref count. You can have arbitrary number of soft links. The file system is not tracking it for you. These are user-defined shortcuts, essentially. So if you have soft links, you can have soft links that go to parents and all that. That's fine, simply because when the file, when backup programs open this file, they can, the file system will tell it it's a soft link, so it can just ignore the soft link and not follow it, okay, for instance. Okay, so I just mentioned all of this. So you can basically have soft links that do all of this. And the big problem here is dangling pointers. Okay? And the circular links, basically you can avoid by just not following soft links or limit the number of soft links that you traverse and whatnot. Okay, so this is how most operating systems will deal with this notion of alias. So important thing to keep in mind is a file can have multiple names that you can achieve through what is referred as referential naming, okay, or links. Okay, so let's stop here because I did want to hand out the midterm.